Warning, this podcast has stories of real-life events and true crime that happens every day. These stories may contain adult language and graphic or disturbing details not suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is advised.
10-1-1, advisory for campus.
Welcome to another episode of War Stories. I'm Tom.
And I'm Chuck.
I was just thinking the other day of how many times I've said, welcome to another episode of War Stories. And I realize I'm reflecting on the fact that I think we're on episode 244. So that's not counting Locker Room, by the way. So if we're on episode 244, and I don't know if I've ever missed an episode of War Stories, and if I have... I've basically said that phrase or some variation of it like 240 times.
Yeah, you've missed it. You've missed it twice.
Yeah, twice.
And that was with Matt Eagle and Blue.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Oh no! And the third time with Matt. Yeah.
I didn't miss it this week. No. And this week our guest emailed us. So tell us about the email, because once again, you email booking@warstories@gmail.com. Booking.warstories@gmail.com. And anyway, booking.warstories@gmail.com. An email that I forwarded to you.
Yeah, it was from Mailbag. Uh-huh. Help me out, guys, because if you send it to Mailbag and then he sends it to me, it's a very good chance I'm going to respond, and I'm going to respond back to him instead of the person I hit reply.
There was a couple of accidental ones where Chuck hit reply instead of reply all, and he emails me back and he goes, oh, do you still want to come on? And I said, oh, it's me. I'm on every week.
Dum-dum. I was like, oh, And so, silly me, but please send it to Booking. It's really easy. You click the link in the bio, go to Booking.
Yeah. So anyway, this week, email we got.
Yeah. So it's from Donald Dunn. He's a retired Army veteran and CEO of the Gun Room Radio. Gun Room Radio is a project.
I like the sound of that.
Yeah, it sounds freaking awesome. When I saw that, I was like, done. Gun Room Radio is a project that was started to help veterans transition from military into music careers. We are a radio station that plays nothing. Oh, yeah, Shannon Book would be great for that. They are a radio station that plays nothing but music by current veterans trying to get into the music industry. So
nice.
I thought that's a really solid thing. And right up our alley. We should. Yeah. Cause he's been doing some really awesome things and been tagging us on Facebook and stuff, but
we should have him back on. But this week we have Donald. Can I call you Donald?
Yeah, absolutely, man. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for coming on. Thanks for emailing us. So I want you to tell us about the website towards the end. I want you to give us all the details, but we heard a little bit about it just now. Let's start with you and how you got to where you're at. And then we'll get some of your stories and then we'll get to what you're doing now. Tell us a little bit about you and how you got into the profession.
So I started out, just like most veterans, I joined the Army, needed a good job, 94. What could go wrong? You know, pretty simple 9-to-5 job at that point.
And that was the Clinton Army, right?
It sure was.
Dude, you were in the Army when Matt was in the Navy.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
All right. Anyway.
Yep. So I joined. I went to the one place I said, you know, there's only one place I don't want to go, and that's Korea, because I just got married and I didn't want to leave my wife for that year. And so I went to AIT and then I went to Korea and
good old needs of the military,
because that's the way it works.
Yep. That's how it works, man. And
big
so
green weenie.
I spent the first year and a half away from the wife. And then I went to, you know, there can't be any place worse than that. And then I went to a place that's worse than that, at Fort Bliss. And I was actually thinking about getting out. Leadership was just shitty, and I hadn't had any positive experiences up to this point. And I hated Fort Bliss so bad that I decided I would re-enlist just to leave, so I didn't have to stay there any longer. I'm not kidding you.
That's probably the greatest reason for reenlistment I've ever heard, and I've been doing this show a while.
If I was stationed at 29 Palms in a year and a half, 2 years in, or 2.5 years in, they're like, hey, if you reenlist right now, we'll get you out of here. I'm like, done. Yeah. Give me out of here.
I hated that place. I really did. And, but it turned out to be a good, good thing. Cause I mean, I credit that to the reason why I made it 20 years. I went from there to Germany and I was in a real combat arms unit, not this fake Patriot shit. And, I went there, mechanized infantry, and I got to see what real leadership is about, you know, NCOs that are really taking care of soldiers. And, that motivated me to want to do more versus getting out. So I volunteered and went to, the special ops side. I went to, the 160th SOAR. I did 10 years with, the 160th. And, after that, I realized, you know, I was getting tired. I mean, between Bosnia and Germany and the 10 years that I was with there, I'd done 68 months between Bosnia, Iraq, and Afghanistan. So I was tired.
Wait, you know what? I just realized new mothers and veterans are the only people that track things in that many months, right?
Yeah.
New moms are like, this is my son. He's 23 months. And you're like, I was deployed for 68 months.
Yep, I counted every one of them, man. I'm not gonna lie.
Right. You know?
But they weren't all bad. And it gets old. It does.
16 months is a long time.
Yeah, it was almost 20% of my career was spent in the desert. I don't even go to the fucking beach anymore. I've seen enough sand to last the rest of my damn life.
Yeah. You know?
My wife's like, let's go to the beach. And I'm like, I guess I'll put on a fake smile face.
Yeah, you're Luke Skywalker at this point. You're like, I don't ever want to see that shit again.
Oh, man.
For those that don't know, sand is your worst fucking enemy.
Yeah.
It gets in your weapons. It gets in your gear. It gets in your weapons.
Yep.
It gets in your gear.
It gets everywhere. And let me explain something about sand for those of you who don't understand. There is a weather condition that goes along hand in hand with sand. If you are somewhere where there is sand, you are also somewhere that is windy.
Yep.
And you cannot unlink the two. And I grew up going to the beach and I hate sand. No, thank you.
Yep. I'll tell you a funny story, man. You know, you cannot predict Kandahar weather. You just can't do it. And I came out of the tent one day and everything was orange. I mean, everything was orange. And I was like, you know, this is early in the Afghanistan war. And I'm like, what the hell is this? And the next thing I know, it started raining mud balls. Like Jesus was picking up mud balls and just chucking them at me.
Gosh.
And what had happened was there was a rainstorm above the sandstorm. And so as the water passed through the clouds, it was collecting mud and just chucking it at us. And I'm like,
that's
this
awesome.
Sounds like even hell. The weather wants us to leave, man.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, I've been in hail. I've never been in mud.
Yeah, me neither. Till that day.
It was a mud storm. Literally, it was raining mud.
Wild.
That's a new Slayer song. Raining mud. Oh,
absolutely, man. But yeah, so I did those 68 months, and you know, as I got older, the 19 year olds ran faster, and I decided
isn't that weird how that happens?
I know, man.
The further you get away from 19, the faster they run.
You know, I had a trick to it, man. I couldn't run fast anymore, but I could run a long time very slowly. And so I would just say, okay, we're gonna run 8 miles today. And just take off running with them. That slowed their asses down.
But oh, yeah.
Me to breathe.
Yeah, so, endurance.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
But that reminds me of, it reminds me of that scene from Colors when they're sitting there and the old P3 is looking at the young buck P2 and they're looking at all those gangsters. And he's like, we can go down and just go.
Oh, no, he says the story of the Papa Bull and the Baby Bull. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's run down there and fuck one of them cows. And the father bull says, no, son, let's walk down. Fuck them all.
Yeah.
It was such a great scene. If you have not seen Colors, go see Hodges. Like my son-in-law, he had never seen it. And he's a Marine. And I showed it to him. And he's like, dude, Hodges, I love Hodges. I'm like, right? He's like, dude, he's like a master sergeant. He's like a gunner. He's like, I would have served with Hodges, man. That guy's so cool. You know, and so now anything that Robert Duvall is in, he's like, oh, it's Hodges. So.
But yeah, so I left there and decided it was time to retire, man. So I took an overseas assignment because the wife wanted to stay there at Fort Stewart. And decided
the wife wanted to stay there?
Yeah, the kids were at that point. The kids were getting close to their junior and senior years in high school, and she didn't want to. She didn't want to move them, and so I left there, went to Qatar, which I thought was okay. Y'all are punishing me and putting me in this shit assignment, but it turned out to be an amazing assignment. I wore a military uniform like 20 minutes a week, so it was awesome. I'm also the only person that has ever deployed from Qatar. Yeah. So I got stuck deploying with our post commander because I was in the special ops, and the battalion or the post sergeant major was my first sergeant in Germany and knew that I volunteered to go there. So he wanted me to become that colonel's driver because I had experience. And so I got stuck going back to Kandahar again. And by that time it had changed, man. There's like dudes on mopeds delivering pizzas to people's tents and shit. And I'm like, what the hell has happened to this place? But
the colonel's driver sounds like a period war movie made for women. Yeah.
I'm going to tell you, man, it was the most boring deployment I have ever had. I literally had nothing to do. I was only there to drive him. And he never went anywhere. Never. Right. So just to have something to do, I washed the vehicle every single day, and I parked it. One day they called me and they're like, hey, the colonel's vehicle broke down. Can you come down and take a look at it? I'm like, thank you, Jesus. There's something to do. And I walked down there and I walked in. I said, what's wrong? They said, oh, the passenger door squeaks.
What?
The passenger door squeaks.
Oh, my gosh.
I walked over to the little janitor's closet, picked up some what do they call that shit?
WD-40?
It was like a floor cleaner, like mop and glow type shit.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Pine saw.
Yeah, pine saw. That's it.
There we go.
I went and grabbed some pine saw, walked over there and dumped it on the hinges, opened and closed it, shut it, walked in. I said, it don't squeak no more. And they said, that's good. And I said, and it smells good. So I walked off.
I can understand if you're relegated to using kitchen products to get the squeak out of doors for full birds, that getting out of the military starts to look more and more attractive.
Yeah. I mean, so I came back from that and went to an infantry unit there at Fort Stewart. And my plans was to retire from there. And as soon as I got there, they let me know that we were deploying. So then I went back to Ramadi. And, you know, by this time, I was ready. I was burnt out, man. I did not want to go 15 seconds past 20 years. And wasn't even sure I was going to make it 20 years at this point. And I said, you know, this can't be that bad. The unit was going to Al Asad. Al Asad is like paradise, man. You know, there's like four pools and life's just great. You don't never get mortared because the perimeter was so big. The perimeter was like 10 miles out, you know? So you didn't have to worry about getting mortared. Life was good. And I get there.
That's the airbase, correct?
Yeah. Yep. And so I get there and I'm like chilling, hanging out. And all of a sudden, my first sergeant says, hey, they've got a forward base that they want us to set up a maintenance team out there for convoys. And I want you to take three or four guys out there and go set up a maintenance facility. So off to Ramadi, Iraq, I went to a shithole in the middle of this town, you know, getting mortared every damn day. You hear there's an Iraqi base right next to us. You know, I'd sit outside and listen to the 50 cals going off as they were getting their ass handed to them by somebody out in the city. And man, it just, it sucked. It was like literally the worst deployment I'd ever had. And I came back, and a year later I retired. And you know, the real deciding factor, man, was the caliber of soldiers we were getting. You know, this is a real funny story, but it just gives you an idea of what we were getting. Our company commander got in trouble. So his punishment was, the battalion commander said, you need to interview all of your soldiers and come back and tell me what you learned. Well, I had this soldier named Private Thompson. I have no issues with saying his name because he's not smart enough to turn on a radio or a TV. Not even worried about him hearing anything. But so it was his turn to get interviewed. And the commander calls me. I take him up there. We go in. He sits down and the commander goes, Private Thompson, why'd you join the Army? And this kid did not hesitate, man. He said, Call of Duty, sir. And commander looked at him and goes, I get that. You know, your family probably served, your dad or somebody, and you wanted to carry that on. And this kid had the dumbest look on his face. And he looked at me, and I looked at the commander. I said, sir, I think he's talking about the video game. shit. And the kid goes, yes, sir. I was talking about Call of Duty. I thought the Army was like that, but it's not. Can you chapter me? That's exactly what this kid said. The commander looked at me. I said, you called him in here. I don't know what to tell you.
Oh, my God. No, shit, huh?
It took me 18 months to get this kid out of the Army.
18 months to get him out.
They would not.
That was, what year was that?
2013.
Okay, that tracks. Yep. That tracks. Because we had a kid in our unit, I want to say in 2010, and he was just claiming PTSD and all this other shit. And I'm like, where'd you get PTSD, bro? And he was trying to say from all of us, you know, NCOs and stuff, yelling at him and all this stuff. And we actually had to go out into his little single wide trailer in the middle of some field that had no power to it, grab him out of this meth den and drag him back because he went AWOL, and we had to throw him. We just kidnapped him, basically, is what we did. Threw him in the fucking back of the car, brought him back, smoked him. And yeah, it took that long about to get out, but he just was that standard shit bag that joined and was like, no, I don't want to do this anymore, when he got there and just wanted anything to do to get out. It's funny though. Call of Duty, huh?
Yeah, man. That's the one and only time. This kid, man, I'm going to tell you, I had nothing but trouble with this kid, man. I think, you know, now that I think about these stories, I even, all the way back to my first soldier was like an adventure. I'm starting to see a trend here, but this kid, man, we had this time period because, you know, everybody hated life so much that we were all getting DUIs and shit. So they started making us talk to every single person on Saturday and Sunday in the morning, find out what their plans were. If they were going to drink, advise them on how to drink and not to drive and everything else. And then I had to call my platoon sergeant or my first sergeant, tell him. And then he had to call the sergeant major and tell him what everybody in the company's doing. Right. Stupid. This kid would not call me. I told everybody, call me at 8 o'clock. Tell me what you're going to do. I'm going to write it down and let's enjoy the rest of our day. This kid would not call me. So I finally started, I told him, I said, look, from now on, you're going to get a text message with a location. Your ass is going to show up there and you are going to take a picture of you in a video telling me what you're going to do that day. And he got to see so many sights in Georgia. I had it from one end of Georgia to the other.
I fucking love the fuck games.
Man, but you know, and I had to scare his wife to get him to do it because he wouldn't have listened to me. So I told his wife that y'all are fixing to be starving to death because we're going to kick him out of the Army. And so she forced him to toe the line and do the right shit. But man,
she's like, figure your shit out. We need the money.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. When I chaptered him, I chaptered him for sexual assault. That's how I got rid of him. He, holy shit. His wife was like 9 months pregnant, 8 months pregnant. And they hired some MP's wife to take baby pictures of her while she's pregnant, pregnancy pictures or whatever they call them.
Yeah.
And that's how he got her number. And then he would like lay in his bed at like 2 o'clock in the morning, texting this MP's wife. So you going to get with me or what, man? You know, you want to see me tomorrow? Man, you look so good. And she's like, leave me alone. And so finally she told her husband, who was an MP, and they filed assault charges on him. And that's how I got rid of him.
No shit, huh?
Yeah. And she still came begging to me not to kick him out.
Please. Oh,
that was
please.
That was your last one? That was your first one?
No, that was the last one. My first one, man, to this day still blows me away. So I just got promoted to E5. He was one of the first soldiers I got. And he comes to me like shortly after coming to Germany. And he goes, hey, Sergeant, how do I enroll my wife into high school? And I said,
shut the fuck up.
What?
Oh, my God.
I am not lying to you. I said, do what? He said, yeah. What? He said, my wife dropped out of high school to get married and come over here. And he's like, I want her to finish high school and get her. So I'm thinking,
good for him.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. I'm like, well, I did all the legwork on how do you get this 18-year-old girl into high school. And we got her in, and for a few months, life seemed to be good. And one day, I get a call to show up over to his house because him and his wife got into a fight, and he got pissed and decided he was going to go buy some weed so he could mellow out. So she called the chaplain, the first sergeant, and CID, and when he came back, they were all sitting in his front room, and he walks through the door with weed in his pocket. And she's like, I just want him to stop doing drugs and playing this sob song. And he literally looked at her and goes, well, you know what? At least I'm not the one that's bringing these high school girls home and making me fuck them. And I'm like, did he really just say that?
Oh, shit.
So he got in trouble for adultery. Having sex with underage girls and weed. It didn't take
long. Oh.
How long was that Briggs sentence?
You know, he got 30 days. It starts out at like 45, and then as long as you don't get in trouble, they deduct a day for every week or so that you don't get in trouble. So
hey, real quick. If you get accused, tried, and convicted of a sex crime while you're in the military, do they report that shit to the sex offender registry?
So it depends on what it is. If in this case where it was him texting her and so forth, they did not do a court martial. And so he got an Article 15, which is non-judicial, and then they sent him on his way. If you actually assault somebody, in this guy's case, he got a court martial, and yes. Because any court martial is an automatic felony,
right?
And you're a sex offender.
So and double jeopardy, correct? You do your break time, then you go and do county time.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Double fucking jeopardy. They don't care if it happens. Also, I think if it changes, if it happens out in town or if it happens on base too. Because if it happens out in town,
the reason they have to become a registered sex offender is because of the county prosecution, not because of the military prosecution. So,
correct.
Okay. So that's my question. Is the military prosecution does not require them or make them become a registered sex offender. It's the fact that the military doesn't stand in the way of the county prosecution or the state prosecution. Got it. Okay. Yep.
Dude, just like that
law that came out when any domestic violent crime, you can't possess a firearm, which means you are now non-deployable and the Army no longer needs you. So they used to allow you to only have the weapon when you go to the range and have the weapon when you deploy, but now it's nope, you cannot have a weapon. So they chapter you.
Yeah. I mean, as a police officer, you got one shot. If you get popped for a misdemeanor domestic violence charge, the only shot is that the court will look at the case and grant you a one-time hall pass to keep your gun. And if they don't, Right. Your department can get rid of you.
Yeah.
Different than my agency. That's crazy.
It also
depends if it was sustained or not, too. For us, they'd straight up just fire you. Well, if the moment they found out if it was sustained, whether it's misdemeanor or felony, boom, gone.
Yeah.
But they took your gun long before. We had a guy. Not my unit, but my next door neighbor, when I was living in Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, he got set up by, I guess, some people. I don't know. This is just the shit that I heard, but he was my next door neighbor and I heard him get his ass beat and I heard him go unconscious. And then the cops and FD show up and all that stuff. Long story short, he ended up banging the sister of one of his guys in his unit who was 16 or 17. And, he sent his kids away for the night. They had a party at the house and we're like duplex neighbors. So we share a common wall. And then next thing I know, it's like midnight and he gets his ass beat and you hear the fighting, you hear the scuffling. I'm like, what is going on? I felt like I was in the room because it's such a thin wall. And long story short, he got popped by Jacksonville PD. And then he went to the brig and he served something like fucking 12 or some odd years and then had to do more time on the outside. I was like, holy shit.
Yeah.
I mean,
his house was clean in a week. It was gone. Sucked. Like a ghost. Yeah. So, Donald, you did time in the 160th SOAR.
Mm-hmm.
How was that?
Man, that was the best 10 years of my military career. I'm not even going to lie. You know, so I got there in 2000, as a matter of fact, September of 2000. So I went through Green Platoon for selection, and I got to spend a year before all the deployments and everything started kicking in. And our first deployment while I was there was February of 2002. So we were like the second or third battalion to actually rotate over. And man, it was, I couldn't have picked a better unit, especially now that I've done a deployment with the regular army versus the special ops side. Right. And I'll take that special ops side any given day. Life is so much better. It is. There's a lot more work and you do a lot more things, but everybody is like volunteered to be there. So, you know, everybody rolls up their sleeves and right. does whatever has to get done. You know, everybody's first name basis. And
that's what I loved working about Narco mm-hmm. was to get into that unit. You had to want to get into that unit. Nobody got ordered to be there. It wasn't a unit that you got put into because you had fucked up, right? You had to want to be there. And they only took guys that were good at their job. And so you didn't have to deal with LOPs and career rookies and guys that were retired on duty. So when you went out with the specials, you're dealing with guys that are already known for working hard and putting in effort. And so it's like, oh, it's so nice to be around like-minded people that are willing to do like work hard, play hard.
Yeah.
You know, let's do some work.
Absolutely. You know, and you know, as I was a diesel mechanic, that's what I did in the military. And, you know, then you go there and you're going through Sears school and all these other advanced trainings. And then you get sent over there and they're like, hey,
did you do that up here? Cause there was a Sears school up here in North Idaho, Washington state.
No, that was on the East Coast.
Oh, okay.
So then you get overseas and they're like, hey, we need a DART team, a downed aircraft rescue team. And so, you know, they're just grabbing people and saying, hey, we're going to train you and you. So I became on the DART team. And, you know, it was one of those things you're like, I don't, you know, you'll never use this. You know, we're too damn good. You know, we're the 160th. We're not going to get shot down. Right. And, you know, that worked great until 2005, you know, during Operation Red Wing when, you know, if you've seen that show, the Lone Survivor.
Lone Survivor, yeah.
Yep. So I had just rotated back to the States about 10 days, 12 days before that happened. And the flight commander, Major Reich, you know, 2 weeks ago, I was briefing him slides and complaining because he was a tough ass leader and hard on you. And you know, he treated me just like any of the other officers. If I had misspelling on my slides or anything like that, he made me correct them. And he was just a good leader. And, you know, you had Marcus Morales, probably the best flight medic I've ever seen in my life. He was better than most doctors. He served with the 75th Ranger Battalion for multiple years and had multiple awards from those encounters. And, you know, and then Kip Jacoby, another guy that always came up and was talking to me at the motor pool. And, you know, me and him would shoot the shit about cars. And him and his fiance was building some raggedy ass G body, I think it was. And, you know, he was going to propose to her and everything when he got back. And 2 weeks after getting back, you know, 12 days or so, come to work, and I find out that we had a downed aircraft that they did not release who it was or what had happened. They just said it was bad. And as we found out what had happened, you know, 16 people died that day. It was 8 SEALs and 8 160th members. That doesn't include the four guys, I think it was, that was on the mountain.
Marcus's team.
Yeah. You know, they didn't include them. So you add them into it, you're now at like 19 people that died that day. And
wasn't it the single largest single day loss of special operations lives in U.S. history, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. And so, you know, that whole thing, I mean, I remember looking on Predator feed, watching as they were circling over the wreckage site until they could go in there to recover the bodies and sensitive items and everything else. And, you know, you just ask yourself, man, how the hell did that happen?
Right.
You know? And,
wasn't it like a lucky RPG?
It was a guy, or
unlucky, depending on which side you want to look at.
I will tell you, they could probably never make that shot again. Yeah. Right. I don't know if you know much about Chinooks, but when they land, the pilots are looking at the sky. They can't see the ground because they land backwards down.
Right.
So the crew chiefs are all looking out the windows, the side windows, and they're counting the pilot down to touch the ground. You got the SEALs that are on the back ready to come out. And the back ramp was down, and the RPG round went into the back through the back gate and hit the internal fuel tank.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, it was I had heard that it was went through the open door, and that's what was the
Yep, it was you know. and deployments changed after me for that, man. You know, I mean, I think all of us, not just me, all of us had gotten to the point like we're just going to go do our job and come home. You know, nothing's going to happen to us. This is, you know, it is what it is. And it happened, you know, when we got over there. Everybody would go out on mission. The people that were back would stand around a burn barrel or whatever, and we'd say some prayers and then stand there and talk and chat. And, you know, they came back and this wash, rinse, repeat. Nobody was ever hurt until that day. Wow. And so it woke a lot of people up. And it changed, you know, things about that changed for me as well. You know, having to help do the funerals and then helping Marcus's wife, you know, pack up their house to move, and his kids run around. It kind of brought back memories like this could be my wife. Somebody could be here packing up her house.
Right. You know?
And it really brought the reality of war home. You know, it was a tough time. I mean, for the longest, man, I never even talked about it. You know, if I did, I would break down in tears. And,
do you think you felt untouchable up to that point?
Oh, absolutely.
Because I feel like with that incident in particular, you know, we're so good at showing people how good we are.
Yeah.
And, you know, I go back to, I don't know if you ever read the book or saw the film, Flight of the Intruder.
I have not.
It came out. After Top Gun, it was like the movie people were trying to find another movie that was like a Top Gun, but it was set in Vietnam and it was about two pilots that steal an intruder and go do some damage. Right. But I remember the opening scene was a guy in a rice paddy with a long rifle, single, you know, a Mosin Nagant, like Russian. So, and he just cranks off a round at this, you know, this A7 or A6 intruder that's going by, and it just happens to go right through the cockpit and kill the bombardier, right? Just stupid shot. And I remember thinking how that would probably shake me worse than like the movie Platoon, where you're on the ground, you're expecting, you know, rounds coming down range, right? And so I feel like with the special operations community and probably, you know, military members in general, when you see these untouchable guys, these tier one guys that are, they're unkillable, man, they're super deadly. And then it's not some amazingly great, brilliant plan that takes them down. It's some lucky shot from a goat farmer with an RPG.
Yeah.
And that randomness of it, I think is enough to make you go, God, what the hell? You know, like, really? Like that's the military equivalent of slipping and falling on a fucking banana peel.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, look at what caused that. If you go back to those chain of events, right? What caused all that to happen? It was a 13 and a 15-year-old boy and an old ass goat herder.
You're right.
That's what started that whole chain of events.
Yeah. What is
the decision? Do we kill these guys or do we let them go?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I don't think either one of the choices would have changed any of the outcome. Right. You know, both of them was going to result in the same thing. Either the Taliban was going to go looking for them when they didn't bring the goats back, or you release them and they're going to go tell the Taliban. It was either or.
Right.
So
there was just a shitty situation.
Yeah.
All around. But yeah, I could see how that would, like, beyond combat or beyond some of the other stuff that you were ready for, you'd mentally prepared your. No, who's going to mentally prepare themselves for a Chinook to be taken out from a lucky shot from a rocket? And even then, the rocket propelled grenade lucky shot takes them out when they happen to be full of spec ops guy. You know what I mean? Like, it was such the, yeah. I could see why that would be. Are you like, that's an, are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, like you said, you can prepare yourself if you got shot. And right. if I clear a room and it happens, you know, those situations, it's one of two things is going to happen. I'm either going to win or I'm going to lose, you know? And you don't think about the, oh shit, what if this fluke thing happens?
Yeah. Right?
And so when that type of stuff happens, reality really does set in. You realize that what you're doing is not a job. You can't be trained how to make this widget on this assembly line, you know, like you can in factory. What we do, every mission is unique. You know, everything has a different situation, and you can practice scenarios, but you're not going to cover everything. You can what if the mission, you know, all day long.
Right. Right. Yeah.
So yeah, it's tough. You know, and I've been on other sides where, you know, like you said, I thought I was prepared and everything else. And I got put in a few situations where I was like, holy shit, how did I get here? You know,
right.
We was on a Chinook flying from Bagram back to Kandahar. And I don't know what was wrong with it. I seen the crew chiefs and everybody talking, and the sergeant major had his headgear on and he was listening. And next thing I know, we're on the ground. Some sort of fuel related problem, and they had to set the aircraft down. And when you look out the windows of Chinooks that the windows have already been shot out of, and you're looking around and you're in the lowest part of the ground and everything's mountainous around you, and you look up and you see the other aircraft circling above you like vultures, man, you quickly get a different perspective on your battlefield. And it changes the way things look really quick.
Yeah, yeah, it's true, man. So you end up retiring, mm-hmm. and what we've talked about this on this show. So just so you're aware, I don't know. I mean, it's not, it's a recurring theme, but it's not a regular conversation. Mm-hmm. Is that the military does a whole lot to prepare you to go to war.
Yep.
They do nothing to prepare you to go home.
You know, what I tell people is the military will give you every tool you need to survive. They're going to give you food, shelter, equipment, even down to the emotions that you have. How do you deal with a problem? You deal with it with anger. Can't pass your PT test? Get pissed. You know,
right.
Use that right. as fuel. You know, when you're fighting the enemy, get mad.
Right.
You know,
the anger is a gift mantra.
Right. And right. so when you get out and you start encountering civilian situations and you reach in that toolbox and the only damn tool you have to pull out to deal with the situation is anger. It's right. the only emotion right. that you've learned.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was, but before I even got out, man, I was not in a good shape. Things were changing about me and I wasn't noticing it. My family was. And I talk about this in the book that I just released, but I wrote the book because most soldiers feel it is better to not tell their family about what has happened over there
mm-hmm.
than to talk about it when you get home. When you get home, you want to believe that you are protecting your family, right?
Right.
But then when you lose your shit, like I did, what is it that they're going to understand?
Right.
Never said anything to my wife knew. I mean, she didn't sleep in the same bed with me for 2 years because she was getting hit and elbowed and everything else. And she got tired of hearing me scream. And I would wake up and sit up in the bed and she would ask me, what's wrong? I said, just a bad dream. And she'd say, well, what's it about? And I said, oh, I don't remember. You know, I wouldn't talk about it. I did remember. I just didn't want to tell her.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's a great scene in, if any of you have never seen the movie Heat, first of all, it's an amazing cop flick, action flick. But there is a scene where Al Pacino is a cop. He's talking to his wife and I remember specifically, he says, so if I come home and I tell you that at work today, some junkie asshole put his newborn baby in the microwave because it wouldn't stop crying, that's going to make it better. Telling you about that is going to make it somehow better. Yeah. No, it's just going to contaminate you.
Yeah.
Right. And so there is that element of, you don't have this stain on you. I don't want to stain you with it.
Yep.
Right. Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was going to say a lot of it comes down, I think, to being that protector. I mean, you join the military because you want to be a protector. Law enforcement, you want to be a protector. Firefighter, you want to be a protector. You know, and so when these bad things happen to you, the first thing that comes into your mind is, I need to protect my family and insulate them from this. And I don't want to tell them a little bit, maybe, but I can't tell them everything, because if I do, it's going to be really rough on them. And I'm exposing them to all these micro traumas and things like that. And it's like, I don't want them to have these bad images in their head. But at some point, I think that when you're struggling, you do have to have an outlet to talk to. And sometimes you might need to take that leap of faith with your loved one and just hope that they can understand where you're coming from and talk to them. And then maybe that can help you get someone else to talk to them. Yeah. That would be a little bit better and still insulate them and protect them. But I think that the major thing is not wanting to expose your loved ones to all the traumas that you've suffered, because you don't want them to feel like you do on a daily.
Right. Did you have a moment where you realized that was short-sighted and not like that? Was there an epiphany, or was this something you realized over time? Like, how did you?
No, man, I did the worst thing you could probably ever do as a father, man. And that was the moment. So this went on as I was going through the out processing, right? Mm-hmm. My temper was out of control. I didn't file a VA claim for 3 years after I got out of the military because I got mad at the VA rep there at Fort Stewart. I came out of another briefing and it was early in the morning and he was standing in front of his office, and I had a VA appointment the next day to go through all my paperwork and everything. And I walked up to him and I said, "Hey, I need to ask you a question." And he said, "Do you have an appointment?" I said, "No, my appointment's tomorrow. I just have a question." He goes, "Well, today is not a walk-in day. It's a appointment only." And he just turned around and went into his office.
What a dick.
You know? Yeah. And I just looked at him. I said, "Well, you know what? Fuck you. I don't need your money." And I walked off. And my temper and my pride and everything else that was going on with me screwed me and made life harder when I did finally file my VA stuff. But at that point, I was in the mode of there's nothing wrong with me. The problem is everybody else.
Right.
And that was starting to cross over me against my family. I would go home, eat dinner, and after dinner, I'd get up and go to the bedroom because that's the only place I felt comfortable, was by myself in the bedroom. And I didn't come back out until the next morning when it was time to go to work. And then when I did finally get out and started looking for a job, I looked for a job that would allow me to be alone. And so I started my own trucking company, bought a truck, and I got in a truck driving 11 hours a day, sleeping in sleeper by myself and on the road for 6 weeks at a time. And all that did was put me in my head. And, you know, then you get to the point where all the politics and everything started coming out. And then that just put me deeper and deeper and deeper. Well, one day there was a hurricane coming and my family's still out there in Georgia. And so I turned around and started heading home to be there at the house. I delivered the load and took off towards the house. And I got there. We boarded everything up. And everybody, it seems like everybody in Georgia lives in trailers. So I was the, you know, out of everybody I knew, I was the only one in the house. So I had my daughter, her husband, my son, his girlfriend, her kid, her sister, her mom, my cousins, had all these people in this house. And it turned out to be a slow moving hurricane. And I was trapped in this house and the anxiety was just building up and building up. And finally, after the hurricane had passed and we were able to come out of the house, I went for a walk trying to get this anxiety to go away. Cause the only thing that made it go away was a fight. You know,
well, I'm going to guess it reminded you of being stuck in that town, getting mortared or waiting to get mortared constantly. And even people are going to be like, "What? No, he's a bit." No. I'm going to tell you right now, just the stress of being locked in a house with a bunch of people that you don't normally get locked in a house with, and then waiting for a natural disaster to happen will stir up the exact same emotions of sitting in your bunker waiting to get shelled. And the next thing you know, you are just as jacked up emotionally as you were back then.
You know, I will tell you how bad, you know, about that time frame, I would come home and do like a 36-hour reset at the house. And sometimes the anxiety of just the fact of going home was more than I could deal with. And I knew if I went home, there was just going to be a fight, because that's eventually it was going to boil over and I was going to start a fight. So there's been times that I slept 25 miles from my house over the weekend and then went back out on the road for 6 weeks.
Wow.
Just because I didn't want to go home. And that's how bad it went. Well, I went for a walk after that hurricane. And when I came back, my son, you know, it didn't help. I still had the anxiety, and my son and my wife got upset at each other. He wanted to leave, and we were under a curfew. Nobody was supposed to leave the house or the areas, you know, because of all the power lines that were down and everything. And he wanted to go to his girlfriend's house to check on the house. And she didn't want him to go. And that's all it took for me to explode. I mean, I just lost it. I got in his face. It almost turned physical. My wife had to break us up. And before I could even think clearly, I threw my son out of the house the day after a hurricane. And that destroyed our relationship. That was already rocky to begin with.
Right. Right.
You know, and that was the moment where I knew, you know, the problem isn't everybody else. There's no normal dad that would throw their son out of the house, you know, after a hurricane, not even knowing if he has a house
right,
they were living in.
Right.
Yeah. And so, you know, me and my wife had been married since seventh grade, or been together since seventh grade. We got married right out of high school. So, you know, and we're still married today, and you know, going on almost 30, this July will be 30 years. But I will say, you know, that period did put a huge void between us. And so I ended up closing my trucking company after COVID, just because I had gotten some help. I went and seen I wouldn't go to the VA. I still wouldn't swallow my pride to file a VA claim. And I went to a civilian therapist who, luckily enough, turned out to be the guy that had set up the whole PTSD program for Fort Stewart and that town there. So he was an amazing doctor, and he put me on some medication, and you know, at that point I started leveling out, and then I seen for myself, you know, the damage that I have done. And it doesn't feel good. It just kind of backs up and confirms what I've been saying in my head the whole time. I'm a piece of shit, and
right,
I'm better off to not be alive. And then when you see it and you can't deny it anymore, nobody else did this stuff. I did it.
Right.
You know? So my mom got to the point where she had to have either a nursing home or somebody had to live with her. And financially, my business wasn't doing very well. I was undercapitalized and in debt up to my ears. And so, and all that came from piss poor decision-making before I got help, you know?
Sure.
I wanted a diesel pickup truck so bad. And one day I got mad at my son because I came home, and when I got home, the truck was broke. Probably nothing he did to it. It was just an old truck that broke, but I blamed him. And to rationalize that, I'm never going to let him break this truck again. So I got on Facebook and I traded the truck the next day for a piece of shit ass Camaro. You know, no rationalization in what the hell I'm doing. I gave a $10,000 truck for a $2,500 car.
Mm-hmm.
I gave away all my tools, the 78 Camaro that we had, that me and my son was supposed to restore together, that had just sat there now because we don't talk to each other anymore. I gave away all the parts. I gave away all the everything that we had. Threw a tuck cover over it and let it sit there. Still sitting there today. Hmm. And, you know, those are years that I lost with my son over this. And so I ended up moving to Missouri. My wife and kids still live in Georgia. And the reason why was because my mom was going to lose too many healthcare benefits because of how much income you're allowed to make when.
Sure.
She moved to Georgia. So I found a job in Missouri, and I moved her to Missouri. And so I rent a place here at my house in Georgia that I take care of. And man, that's where everything turned out great for me. It allowed me time to take care of myself at this point.
Right.
I got enrolled in the VA. The therapy with the VA did not help. Not, you know, just like everybody else does. And, I started podcasting, man. The show was originally called Two Drunk Dudes in a Gun Room. And it was me and my old first sergeant. And we just wanted all the soldiers that we served with to get back on Facebook and tell stories and laugh and just make sure everybody was okay, because so many people was killing themselves. And so he owned a little gun business. And when I suggested we do a podcast, he said, well, what would we call it? I said, well, we pretty much live in your gun room building guns and drinking beer. Why don't we just call it Two Drunk Dudes in a Gun Room? And it was just a humorous, fun thing to do. And three quarters of the way through the first season, I realized that podcasting had became a form of therapy, man.
Yeah.
I was talking about things that I didn't even feel comfortable talking about with the VA, my wife, and I'm openly talking about it on recordings, and it felt good. It wasn't the same for my buddy. And after the end of season one, he dropped off. And I apologize for my dogs, man. My wife, my mom left, and so they're downstairs barking at every car that goes by. But So I ended up, he ended up falling off, and I left it the same for season two, just in case he wanted to come back. And that's when I started having, veteran musicians that came on. Mm. And I found another problem that they had that us podcasters have, but it didn't matter to me because I had a job, was trying to get seen, trying to get heard.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Unless you've got a shit ton of money, or you just came up with something amazing and you go viral, it's tough.
Yeah.
And these guys are trying to pick up their dreams that they put on hold while they served. And so I've never really been a very thoughtful person. So I just said, you know what, why don't we just start a radio station? You know, these veterans will just give me their music and we'll just play nothing but veteran music. It'll be easy. And I seen an ad that said, start your own radio station for $39.95. Well, hell, I'll do it. Well, it turned out to not be that easy.
Right.
Yeah, it briefed well. But yeah. There's a thing called copyright and everything else. Mm-hmm. And even if the veterans own their music, they do not have the right to allow you to play it because they sign agreements with pros called performance rights organizations, such as BMI or ASCAP. And they're the ones that go around making sure that you're not playing their music without paying. And mm-hmm. So I found a group called Operation Encore. And they kind of gave me the gist of how the music business works. And they helped me in everything as far as get things lined up. So I started a business, called it Gunroom Radio. And I paid for the licensing from BMI and from ASCAP. And I started playing their songs. We've now grown to three channels. Nice. Shannon Book is on there. He's been on there since it started. And, you know, I was there when he came out with his new song called Dear Mom. And
oh, yeah.
An amazing song. He is by far my favorite artist. You know, his song, Not Alone, I listen to it all the time. Because
that's what he had. That song was what when the like when we had him on, he had not not written the song Your Mom yet, but he had, you know, just come out with, or he was promoting that one. And
it's an amazing song.
Yeah,
it's really good.
Yeah.
Well, that's amazing. That's pretty cool. Where could people find it?
So you can go to gunroomradio.com, mm-hmm. and you can all the stations are linked there. Doesn't require any sign in or anything like that unless you use the app. You can find it there, and you can go to whichever station. We have a vet mix. We have a rock station called Ranger Rock Wave, and we have a country station called Semper Fi Country. And
nice.
Yeah, and we came up with these names based off of how many artists were in that genre and what their branch was. And most mm-hmm. of the country branch was made up of Navy and country, or Navy and Marines, and the Army was the majority for the rock side. And so that's where we came up with the names. And man, it's been growing ever since. And then here recently, last 3 or 4 months, we started a Roku channel. And so we have what's called MMTV. It's called Military Music Television. So where we've taken all these videos that these artists have made and put it on a Roku channel for people to watch, just like the old MTV days.
Wow. How do you get something on Roku?
There's a couple different ways. So Roku's open source as far as building, but you can either code it yourself, or there's no code companies that will do it for you. It used to be really super simple.
Awesome.
They recently changed the way their policy is. So now you have to know some coding to build the app yourself.
Hmm.
But yep. If you build it yourself.
Oh my God. I know.
You think what I'm thinking, Tom?
Yeah. I mean, you know, you never know. All right.
No coder.
Yeah. Hey, Donald, we appreciate you coming on. So give out those websites one more time. And then where do you want people to follow you? Where do you want people to keep up with you and see what you're doing?
So the best way to follow me, because I'm super active in our author program that we have. It's called Words from Warriors. There's a magazine that comes out June 1st called The Warrior Scroll. All the veteran artists or veteran authors that have wrote books also write in our magazine. Nice. One of the ways that we fund these projects, that and advertising. That's we don't, as of right now, because we haven't finished the 501c process, we have not been gone out asking for donations. But we do advertising and that magazine. And then the other way is you can email me directly at donalddunn@gunroomradio.com and Donald Dunn on Facebook. You can follow me there as well.
There you go. Awesome. Well, we appreciate you coming on. And, you know, we always like to give our guests a chance to dedicate their episode.
I would dedicate this one to all the people that fell on that day with Turbine 33.
Well, that's as good of a dedication as any for this episode. And rest easy, brothers. We got it from here. So, Donald, thanks for coming on. Chuck, what do you have for us as we
wrap up? Well, I want to say thank you, Donald. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story and sharing your journey through your 20 years in the service, and then what happened after, and what you're still doing, and how you're still helping veterans. Thank you so much. And we look forward to having you come back on again and sharing some more stories from your special ops days. That would be amazing. I want to say thank you, everyone, for listening. Oh, you're welcome, sir. Thank you, everyone, for listening. If you like today's podcast and the content we provide, please follow us and go to our Instagram and our Facebook. Our Instagram is @war_stories_official, and our Facebook is @warstoriespodcast. If you already listen to podcasts, you like our podcast, we're available on all major podcasting platforms, Apple, Spotify, Podbean, all that. You can also go to our website and support us there at www.warstoriesofficial.com. We grab some gear. If you go to our Instagram or our Facebook, click the link in the bio. You can get to all of our links, our socials, our YouTube page, everything, and our emails. Yep. If you have a story you want to share, or you think you want to be featured on the show, or you could be featured on the show, please go to booking.warstories@gmail.com. Again, that is booking.warstories@gmail.com. I can get you booked. We're always looking for law enforcement, veterans, firefighters, medics, also corrections officers, dispatchers, and nurses. And if you have a friend who you think would be a great fit, give them our info, show them our Instagram or Facebook, and link us up. Thank you for the support. Stay safe.
And until our next episode, come home with your shield or on it.